Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. March 27th, episode number 92, On Guard. Every spring I find myself walking out to the bees and wondering what it's like to get back in to the bees when you start going in the hives in earnest. There's that little trepidation about opening the hive for the first time and administering smoke and getting back into the groove and getting that touch, so to speak, after a long winter. With that comes the notion of, will you get stung and when will that first sting of the season come? And how is the hive defense going to work this year? Those notions tell you a little bit about how we're going to open this episode. Hi, everyone. This is Kevin England. Thanks for coming to join us on another episode of the BK Corner. It's Easter night, late, about 11:30. I'm recording the intro now after I've just finished putting the final touches of recording the rest of the episode. And since I have recorded the episode, I can tell you what it contains. Let's run through the agenda. Segment number one is on hive defense. Segment number two is contamination in fresh pollen, a report from the New Jersey State Apiarist on a study they worked on. Segment number three is insights from DVE, Dennis Van Engelsdorp, in the Bee Informed Partnership. Notes and news shared by Joe Lewis. Roundtable number one, American Honey Tasting Society. Roundtable number two, a link to a video from Megan Denver and Tom Seeley on how to look for wild honeybees, Tom Seeley version of bee lining. Roundtable number three, a recap of the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association March meeting and a couple things that were presented there. Making a veil on a budget, that's roundtable number four. Some notes about the perfect beehive stand, roundtable number six. Nope, that's number five. And roundtable number six is a listener mail, Maryland banning neonicotinoid products. So pretty excited about this episode. I have to post the show notes at some point, but the episode's ready to go. And we might as well get started. If you've joined us before, you know the next thing up is the local hive report. Before I get started, though, let me give you an email address if you want to write in, kevin@bkcorner.org. Please let us know your name and where you're writing in from. On that note, I want to say, if you've ever been to our website, bkcorner.org, and took a look at the bottom right-hand corner of the page, there's a map there. It's called Cluster Maps. Used to have one of these on the older website, and since we refreshed the website, we've renewed it, and it shows you all the visitors for March. And what's fascinating to me is to look at where all of you come from. I know from the previous one, we had a bigger saturation of where people came from. A lot of our listeners are in the United States. But as I look across, we touch almost every country in Europe. And looking across, we see some contacts in South America. One click out of Africa. I find that interesting. Some in the Middle East, some in Asia, and a couple here and there from New Zealand and Australia. And even one out there in Hawaii. So as this continues to build, it's always fascinating to see where people are coming from. And you could take a look at that, our website, bkcorner.org. Scroll all the way down on the bottom right-hand corner. There's been 3,000 visits for this month alone. And it's neat to watch that build. So when you write in, tell us where you're calling from. And I'd love to get different viewpoints from overseas. In fact, maybe in our next episode, what we'll do is ask you to send a blurb of where you listen from so we could put names to the locations. Anyway, I'm rambling on. It's because it's the end of the night, even though this is the beginning of the podcast. Let's go ahead and get started. Let's bring you the local hive report. It's been a quiet time for the local hive report since we last visited, but that's going to change in the next couple weeks as the trees are starting to bud and the forsythia is in bloom in this local area. That to me is the sure sign that swarming season is going to begin, and it seems a little bit early this year. We typically don't see it till around the 1st of May, so it's about 2 weeks earlier than normal. It's still cold here on occasion in New Jersey, and there was some snow just this past weekend. Even though we had a day in the 60s this week, it's still a bit early to get into the hives in my estimation, and I've stayed out of them so far. We had 1 week in the 70s a couple weeks back, but I was otherwise occupied, and I didn't get into my hives at that time, but I know a bunch of people did, and they're saying their hives look pretty good since we had a relatively mild winter. I'm all right with not getting into my hives, as I'm not a fan of getting in there early and breaking the propolis seals. Our bees are still snug in their beds on some of these chilly nights, but as I said a moment ago, things are about to heat up. I have a game plan set up for this year, but it's subject to change depending on what I'm going to see in my first full inspections. I'm thinking that my strongest hive is going to be my polystyrene hive over at the farm, and I'm thinking I'm going to leave it alone. It has two deeps and two mediums on it, and I'm pretty confident it has a large cluster already, given the short peek I took to put some sugar and pollen patties on it earlier in the month. This past week, I wanted to see how the food source was holding up that I put in there. I peeked under the lid, and the box was loaded with bees across all of the inner frames and inner cover, and all of the food that I had put in just a short time ago was pretty much gone, like decimated. I didn't check the sugar on the other hives, but my guess is they're doing just as well. I shot a short video if you wanted to take a look at what that looks like. It's on the YouTube page at youtube.com/nwnjba. My thought is this on the 2016 game plan. I'm going to do some splits in the first week of April. I think the weather will be viable by then. I'm going to do said splits on the two Langstroth hives I have and use the polystyrene hive, as I just said, for my honey production. In the interim, I'm going to put two packages in the yard this year, like I've mentioned in previous episodes. Later in April, my guess is sometime around the 15th or 20th, I'm going to take another few frames out of the Langs and split them again. And perhaps along the way, I'll pick up a swarm or two and we'll have a number of hives going into summer. I personally still am taking care of a few odds and ends this week. I finished up one of my bee yard hive benches, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. I saw this design in a bee culture magazine from 2012. That tells you how long I've been wanting to build one of these. And I saw a video on the bee vlog where Bill Catherell makes one of these and he tweaked the dimensions a bit from the original design, and I followed his dimensions and the bench came out perfect. One more winter project to get to, and that's building out a bee vacuum. I have all the parts and I just have to find some time to give it a go. It looks like the first day of spring has passed, and usually I run out of time when that marker has come through to finish my projects, but I still have it in my mind to get that going. I also need to replace my wax melting jig as it got smashed and it's been beat up and it's time to give it a replacement. So I'll have to head over to Lowe's or something and get myself a new styrofoam cooler and put that back together. So I think that's it for this episode's Local Hive Report. Very excited about the season to come up in a few weeks. Segment number one, this one's about hive defense. As a beekeeper, especially if you're a new one, one has a vested interest in understanding hive defense. Like many things in nature, humans included, there is an aspect of the genetic makeup of bees that allow them to come to the defense of their hive when threats are present or they are under attack. In this segment, I'm going to talk about the hive defense system and spend some time exploring the role of the guard bee. Surprisingly, we probably have some notion of how guard bees work, but there are some aspects that might not be what you think. At least that's what I discovered when prepping this segment. The first thing to say is that the guarding of the hive can mean the difference between survival and extinction on the colony level. When a threat is detected, the response is tailored to handle it, but there is more to it than a simple physical provocation response at play. Honeybees are a byproduct of genetics, and some of what happens in defense is predicated on the genetic makeup of the colony. The notion here is that not all things are created equal, and some hives are naturally more defensive than others as a byproduct of their environment and/or their genetics. It would not be a surprise in an apiary of multiple hives to discover that one hive out of many has a different disposition because of the genetics, or, you know, maybe there was a skunk picking at it last night. It's also possible that one yard of beehives would be more territorial and defensive than another yard of bees in a different location because of environmental reasons. Perhaps there's a lot of robbing going on in one yard, or less stores available in that yard, while yard two is fat and happy and everybody's getting along. If you'll allow me to draw the analogy, like humans, it could be said that each hive has its own personality, and it could factor back to the genetics expressed by the queen or other things at play. In a 1987 research article on guard bees, it states, quote, "Studies have noted variability in aggression between colonies, both anecdotally and quantitatively, presents evidence that colonies' aggression is highly heritable. Aggression is apparently not due simply to additive genetic influences, but is influenced by dominant alleles," end quote. So it's not your imagination. Sometimes hives are hot for no particular reason, and when this is true, colonies should be requeened, and perhaps it's a byproduct of their genetics. So in addition to genetics, guarding behavior is influenced by the environment. Guarding, relatively speaking, is one of the minor activities in the hive. While there might be tens of thousands of bees in a colony, the number of bees that are dedicated to the task of guarding the hive in comparison to foragers, for example, is small. At any given time when guards are on duty, you might have 20 to 100 guards total in the hive, and many of them will be in the background waiting for that call to arms. The environmental factor might be that the hive has a bigger exposure area instead of a small quarter-sized hole in a tree. We're going back to the skunk example, or even a dearth. Sometimes what you have is under assault or needs to be protected, so colonies will employ more guards. It's interesting, and a sidebar kind of notion, to think that when there's tens of thousands of bees, only 20 bees will guard the hive. But you have to keep in mind that there's some 20 plus jobs that happen inside the hive, from feeding the young and taking care of the queen and making wax and taking out dead bees as an undertaker and so on. You can imagine the division of labor there. There's not a lot of people, bees, left to do the guarding. So interesting ratio, and I would not have pictured it being that small. So I want to talk about types of guard roles. Let me give you a couple terms here. Patrollers, or crawlers. Workers on call, or I'll call them soldiers. And scanners. Just hold on to that for a second. We'll explain each of those. So guarding the hive comes in a few forms. We might all surmise that the crawlers on the landing boards are where the hive defense occurs. The typical guard bee is known to patrol the front porch and can be at the ready to inspect arriving bees or be on guard and ever vigilant should some sort of intruder show up. A guard at times can be identified by its posture. If you watch closely, you might see a guard bee on alarm, and you'll see them standing on their hind and mid legs with their front legs up in the air. Much like a dog begging, but with their front legs up. They'll be raised up a bit with their mandibles out and their wings in an open position like they're ready to fly. And while this is the typical guard bee description, there are pseudo guards for the colony that may not be instantly recognizable, hence the other types that I've opened with. So the second but better known of the other two is the soldier bee guard type. This is a bee that's on call, so to speak, and will come to the aid of the colony if a guard on the front porch sounds the alarm. These workers are probably in some other role, or maybe they're a recently returned forager that will come to the aid of the colony if need be. I've been told, and believe it to be true, that foragers are more defensive when they are in the hive than the guards themselves. My joke about this is that they tend to be jaded from having been exposed to the outside world. I could tell you that a colony has far more resources defending the hive in the early morning or late afternoon when foragers are still in the picture. Yet a lot of researchers wonder whether or not foragers get pressed into service when it comes to guarding the hive and that call to arms. So the last category of the two that are not crawlers are scanners. Surprisingly, scanners are the bees that are coming back to the hive and see something that's not quite right and will join in the fray or take action on their own behalf. So let's talk about some other facets of guarding the hive. First one is age. If you're thinking about guard bees, the patrollers that are most prevalent in defense, how many are there? How old are they? And about how long do they stay employed in that task? The number we said just a moment ago is varied by the hive, and no two hives have the same amount of guard bees on duty. If you had to put a number on it, researchers say that in any one day there could be an aggregate total of about 100 bees involved in the defense of the colony. That doesn't mean there's 100 literally, but over the course of the day, you might have 100 bees total guarding the hive in some shape or form. It's not so strange a notion when you consider that a guard bee may only be in the role for an hour, literally, in their entire life. It's not atypical for a guard to serve the role as little as a full day, and surprisingly, some could be in the role as long as 16 days. So an hour or less to 16 days. What's the real number here? The research shows that the average time spent guarding is about 1.4 days in total. So bees are, on average, so bees are rotating in and out of this role frequently. Some of them start only an hour. And I'll go back to things we've talked about in the past. My guess, and this is just me thinking out loud, is that some of these bees are the ones that were sitting there waiting for the foragers to come back. And while they've got nothing to do, maybe they press themselves into the service of guarding. There was a commentary I read somewhere that said every bee has inherently a guarding behavior built right into them. So perhaps while they're waiting for forager to return and to get that bounty of what they're bringing back and bring it back inside, they're patrolling the hive and maybe that's when they become guards. How's that for a notion? So to that end, it makes sense to say, what do they do when they're done guarding? The most common observation was that they become foragers. And then once they become foragers, they stay foragers. Now, contrary to what I said a moment ago, there was no observation in the research articles that I've read, and specifically it said this in one of them, is that once they become a forager, they don't go back on patrol at any given point. Now, of course, we just said they could become a scanner, and to me, the clear distinction is that they did not come back and enter into the role of Guard B, but I believe that they would respond to the call to arms. So you might surmise from this insight that bees are in the age range of becoming foragers when they're in this guarding role. So they've been in the hive, they've been taking care of whatever their duties, and they're just about the cusp of being foragers. So how old is it? Observations were that they were as young as 7 days old when they were observed to get started, and some waited as long as 22 days old to be pressed into service as guards. The average age of the bee was around 13 to 14 days when they became guards. So moving on to another facet of guarding the hive, we'll talk about aggressiveness. And a short little tidbit here is, thus far we've talked about the backstory of guard bees. Now we'll focus the attention on the job of colony defense. Aggressiveness is a colony level feature that is variable, and it may be tied to the persistence of the guards. Let me explain what I mean by that. The response is tied to the number of guards on duty. The colonies with the most persistent guards also appear to be the most aggressive towards any type of threat. But the interesting thing about that is, when there's a lot of them, they may attack you or attack whatever it is that's bothering them. But it doesn't mean that since there's a lot of them, you'll get attacked. Huh? What? It's about the perception of the threat. The perception of a threat is not enough to incite a response. So bees will not necessarily sting a threat to the colony on presence alone. So if you're standing there, theoretically, you shouldn't get stung. It's said that the presence of a threat in vicinity of a colony coupled with movement that provides a trigger response for the bees to act. So Kevin moment here. You know, I've been standing near and far on different occasions near my hives, just watching things, no threat whatsoever, and bang, I've been stung for my troubles. So I'm a little bit doubtful of some of this research that says movement is a huge factor. But I do agree that I've also stood in front of the hives and had no problem. But as soon as I started to move, all of a sudden I was being buzzed and menaced and so on, right? So the bees don't read the book sometimes, folks. End of Kevin moment. So that aside, it has been demonstrated that bees will respond when movement is involved. The response may come in different forms, and there's a theory out there about a model of honeybee defense that is expressed in four steps: alerting, activating, attracting, and culminating. So the first of the four steps, alerting, a bee releases an alarm pheromone which alerts the other bees. This might come in the form of an assault on the hive, or maybe when an intruder is detected or other threats. Bees will routinely inspect arriving bees and can detect if they are friendly or hostile by factors that are not totally understood. Of course, the conspicuously jumpy behavior of robber bees in itself might be sufficient to enable entrance guards to recognize that these would-be intruders are not there for a good purpose, but it goes deeper than that. There's a notion that bees can detect other nest mates by a genetic marker, one that is established for individual bees in a colony prior to their emergence as an adult. And it doesn't matter what environmental cues are in place, guard bees can distinguish nest mates from intruders. Of course, we all know that drifting takes place, and if a bee shows up with nectar or pollen, it might be allowed to just pass right through. In my opinion, it seems the circumstance might have as much to do about whether you are inspected at the gate, so to speak. I would assume that a drone poses no threats, so unless they are being corralled, it's that time of year, they're probably allowed to pass right through. And if there's an abundance of forage and bees and other things going on, and bees are coming back with nectar and pollen, they'll probably pass right through. However, when it's a dirt season and people are, you know, the bees are trying to, not people, the bees are trying to defend what they have, I think it's a different ballgame. So continuing our steps, step two is activating. A guard bee releases an alarm pheromone, and this is the signal for other guards and the soldiers in the hive to be pressed into service. The nature of the alarm is inspected and addressed accordingly, and that takes us to step number three, attracting. The first bee moves to the target and begins the defense. It doesn't necessarily invoke every bee, but then again it could. The defense at this point could take the shape of many forms. It's the expulsion of an intruder by dragging them away. It's denial of access. It's bowling an intruder by multiple bees surrounding it and generating heat until they cook whatever their foe is, and it dies from heat, and then they drag it off. There is flying at the intruder, burrowing into the fur or hair of the threat. Buzzing menacingly, of course, buzzing menacingly. Making physical contact or bouncing off of the threat. And as a beekeeper, everybody in their first year probably has had a bee bang off their forehead. Biting or pulling hair. And of course there is, yes, stinging. So stinging takes us to part of attracting and part of step four, which is culminating. The bees culminate to a response area and possibly start stinging. X marks the spot at the first sting and it paints the target, so to speak. A sting leaves behind a chemical marker that invokes other bees to sting in the same vicinity. Of course, there's one other plausible outcome of this. All the other threats combined have convinced whatever it is the bees were trying to defend their hive against to retreat, and it leads to a culmination of all the bees returning to their defense of the colony. There's one other aspect of hive defense that we haven't talked about yet, but is an interest to the superorganism that is a honeybee colony. It comes into play, and it's a different slant on the role of the environment as it plays into the conversation of colony defense. And what I'm talking about is the weather. If you've kept bees for any period of time, you probably encountered a cranky hive and recognized after the fact that weather was coming into your area. The change in weather is said to have an impact to colony defense in some interesting ways. You would think that if it were bright and sunny, the hive would be active and you would be good to be in your hive doing inspections. If you have colonies that are devoid of resources and bees recognize that stores are low, they could be more defensive, and good weather provides high contrast against the sky and makes a target more readily perceived. On the other hand, there's a couple other things that you have to keep in mind. One of them is, if there is lots of forage in abundance on a good day, even if it's bright and sunny, it yields a smaller population in the hive because everybody's out working, and anyone that is home is otherwise preoccupied with what's going on inside the colony, and you have a smaller number of guards on duty. And again, they're not seeing the threat because huge resources are coming back and they're just letting things happen. Moderate to high winds could play in your favor for inspections, as they serve to dissipate any alarm pheromones that might be issued. So you might hedge your bets on a windy day. Another thing is cool and overcast. Windy, damp days may tone down the contrast of you being there as an opposite to the bright, sunny days, and results in bees that are less inclined to be defensive. As alluded to earlier, some indicate that a falling barometer for a storm approaching is all the bees need to get their guard up. And I ask you, would you want someone to pull the roof off of your house if it was going to storm? I think the answer is no. I always say that when the forage is on and the weather is fair, that's the right time to work the bees, especially in the middle of the day. Everybody's preoccupied and happy with the nectar being in full swing, and you get that happy hum in a hive. I've had some challenges in the early morning and late night sessions, and know that bees can certainly be awful fickle during a dearth or when the winter is approaching and you're opening a colony and it's a little too cool for their liking. So there's a couple more things to think about when working with bees that get their dander up for colony defense. First one is presentation to the hive. If they see movement all the time out in front of the hive and you're just another thing moving, you tend not to be in trouble. But if it's still as can be and you come into the field of view, you could potentially tip them off and cause them to respond. The same can be said by the vibrations you create when you run through with a mower or when you're banging on the hive trying to pry the lid off when there's some sort of vibration of breaking the propolis seals and things like that. I also know that beekeepers tend to get a little bit of an awakening call when they open a hive, take the inner cover off, and they lean over and present themselves to the bees that are on notice on top of the frames. When you see a little bit of that, it's always good to stand to the side and just give a short puff across the slides. And some people even say that the best way to prevent colony defense is to sing or make noise, talk to your bees, and they tend to get used to the karma of your voice and your actions, and to them, you're just another bee in the landscape. Now, I don't know how much I believe in that. We've talked about that in the past, but it doesn't hurt, I believe, to present yourself and also use judicious smoke to mask any pheromones that do get triggered should you have some sort of problem. So colony hive defense, pretty interesting topic. I have a number of resources I use to pull this information out. There's quite a bit to look at, and if you're interested, you could check our show notes for this episode and look for some interesting links to colony hive defense. www.bkcorner.com. Look for show notes as the tag, and you're looking for episode number 92. Segment number 2, contaminated fresh pollen. I don't care to disparage state apiarists across the United States, but I have to say that we are so fortunate here in New Jersey to have one of, if not the best state apiarist in Tim Schuler. Tim is a tireless worker on behalf of the beekeeper. And case in point, I promised in a previous episode to circle back on a report that he gave in our 2016 winter meeting entitled, How Land Use Affects the Quantity and Concentration of Pesticides Found in Fresh Pollen, Fresh Stored Pollen in Honeybee Hives. I'm going to talk about the details and outcomes of a study Tim conducted with the help of others. I'll tell you the intention, set up how it was conducted, and then give you the summary results. I would encourage you to take the time, if you are so inclined, to watch the presentation, which is on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/NWNJBA. The study itself was conducted through 2015 and was inspired by a curiosity of how much pesticide would be discoverable in a fresh pollen sample taken around the state. An added aspect of this was to sample from different land uses and see if the differences impacted what bees were being exposed to. There was one other facet to the study, and that was to see if the time of year yielded any clues about what the bees were being exposed to. They settled on 5 types of land use based on New Jersey's geography: forested areas, urban areas, suburban areas, agricultural areas that are predominantly corn and soy, and the last one is agricultural areas that are predominantly vegetable farms or vegetable. The goal was to collect samples on a monthly cadence for 6 months and visit 5 apiaries in each of the land use types. Tim collected the samples for particular land use and then combined them together in the end. For example, let me clarify that. He went to 5 forest-hosted apiaries in the state, sampled fresh pollen from each one of them, and then combined the forest ones together and sent them off to the lab for analysis. In order to pick the target apiaries, he did a survey of New Jersey beekeepers and then analyzed the volunteers to find the ones that matched the zones the best. Once they settled on the participants, he developed the routes for sampling and let beekeepers know that he would be visiting. He had standing arrangements to get access without having to make pre-planned arrangements to access the property. He could go at his leisure and just go right in and access the hives. He did not have to have permissions to go in and get them. 4 routes were chosen that encompassed all corners of the state. Add all the routes together and it was approximately a 900-mile loop on each run. He did these samples once a month, and if you had to drive it all at once, it was around 24 hours of driving time, taking into account the half hour at each apiary along the way to collect and process the samples. You'll see more information about the routes and information on the land types if you take the time to watch his video presentation that I shared a moment ago. So now that you have the gist of the study, let me share the outcomes. In the order he presented the data in the presentation, I'll summarize what he reported. Thymol was the most prevalent mite treatment in parts per billion, also known as PPBs, of the samples taken. Fluvalinate was also found along with DMPF, which is a metabolite of ametraz. He shared what the PPBs were for each of the samples found and what months had the highest samples. Part of his commentary was while he was sharing the results with some of these findings, especially herbicides and others, it's hard to tell if these values, the PPBs, are troublesome or not. I seem to recall that Dave Tarpey and Randy Oliver said something similar about parts per billion on some of these products when they came to present to us, as it is somewhat a voodoo science to say how many PPBs it takes to become detrimental to a bee. And you also have to keep in mind that adult bees, larvae bees, queen bees, all get affected by these things differently, so when they're exposed to them, who knows if different PPBs matter for the different age types. Tim's conjecture, which is plausible in a simple approach, is big numbers in the parts per billion are not a good thing, but what constitutes big, as we were just talking about, is hard to say. So continuing on, 3 herbicides were reported, pendimethalin being the largest sample recorded at 245 parts per billion in the August time frame. And the zone where it was recorded was the ag vegetable one. there were 7 fungicides picked up in the samples, with chlorothalonil being the most prevalent one at 522 ppbs, found in July and August. These were reported in both the ag vegetable and the forest area zones. Insecticides also turned up in the samples. Chlorpyrifos was the leader here at 47.3 ppbs. The dreaded imidacloprid was also in the mix at the smallest concentration of 2.2 ppbs, but so many people in beekeeping have an interest in that particular product that I thought I'd call it out in the study here. In the end, the number of pesticides by land use turned up highest in the ag vegetable area, with forest in second and ag corn soy coming in next. The highest levels of residues overall were picked up in the ag veg and forest areas, respectively. So the forest area turned up to be a surprise. Tim speculated that his forest areas may have been impacted by the lack of pure forest region in New Jersey, and that perhaps they were affected by pockets of ag veg or other zones that the bees could get to, even though it was predominantly forest. Another way to say this is perhaps it was forest, but there is enough human property and diversity mixed in to change the designation from pure forest. Whatever the case, the conclusions that in New Jersey it is evident that the bees are bringing in chemicals back to the colonies. One of the objectives was to determine what months were the most impactful for bringing chemicals back, and it turns out that from the data, it indicated August 1st and then July. As a New Jerseyan, it isn't much of a surprise, as bees will scrounge during those months for anything they can find, as there's often a dearth in that time period across the state. Like most researchers, Tim shared that more work needs to be done, but I say bravo to the effort and the hours that got put in. I would also give a tip of the cap to the beekeepers who opened their doors to Tim to get this study up and running. He said at the outset that he has to do this for 6 months, or that was the original game plan. In the end, they could only muster 5 months, but it was still a great body of work. I suggested to him that if he would be game to do it again this year, to let me know, as I would be pleased to do the loop that is in my section of New Jersey. As it was, he relayed that one time when he was out, he got stuck on a highway closed for dozens of hours somewhere out over by Newark. And I don't know if he wants to repeat this again, because what a horror that was that day. For me personally, it makes me think about how it relates to beekeeping practices. My area is a combination of the 3 areas that turned out to be the highest impacts. My lot is primarily wooded, but I'm surrounded by ag, corn, and soy, and ag vegetable. Ugh. Strategically, one thing I think about is perhaps I might consider feeding my bees in July and August and keeping them out of something where they're going to get exposed to who knows what. Maybe that's a fool's notion, but the data serves as an input for me as a curiosity about what's going on here in New Jersey. And again, I can't thank Tim and the team that worked on this enough for the effort. I say bravo, bravo, bravo. So look for a link to the direct video of Tim's presentation in our show notes. Segment number 3, we call this one DVE. Listener Joe Lewis sent in a report recently from the Susquehanna Beekeepers Association, as they had Dennis Van Engelsdorp in for a presentation, and they sent along some interesting notes of the summary. They weren't able to record the presentation, but they were able to take the highlights of the notes, and they did a really interesting job. And since they went through the troubles of sending him along, I'm going to spend a minute and share some of what they learned. I'm only going to hit the highlights in hopes of whetting your appetite to go to their website and see the complete notes. More on that in a second. So there were several pages of notes here, and this was from a meeting held March 9th, 2016. And I'm just going to hit some of the main points, and I'll get started with literally reading some of these word for word so you can capture what was said. So the first component was about bee losses, and they're talking about losses in 2014. Increasing summer losses versus winter losses in 2014, the difference in loss rates between backyard beekeepers and commercial beekeepers was noted according to the BIP surveys, that's Bee Informed Partnership that Dennis Van Engelsdorp has a significant part in. The main cause of 2014 colony losses were number one, queen loss, number two, varroa, number three, starvation. It says, unsurprisingly, backyard and commercial beekeepers disagree on causes of colony loss. And I'm reading these directly from the notes. The next topic that I'm going to call out here in the notes were three main problems in beekeeping persist: pesticides, varroa, and monoculture crops. In the 1980s, 20 mites per 100 bees was the threshold for colony loss. Now it is 3 per 100. And if your bees get to 5 mites per 100 or greater, the colony will likely suffer damage. And we know, we've talked in the past, it has to do with the viruses being vectored out of the varroa mites. So it's interesting that they list pesticides as the first thing and varroa as second, probably as a backyard beekeeper. And you have to mind that Bee Informed is taking surveys everywhere, but as a backyard beekeeper, it's probably more about varroa, and that would be ranked number one. But the overall data from BIP suggests that pesticides are the first thing. So it goes on to say 70% of backyard beekeepers don't treat for mites, meaning they use a known treatment for mites, and mites can be passed to other colonies, to your neighbor's bees, through drifting and robbing. It suggests a good idea for everyone in an area or a group is to agree to treat all at the same time, as mites are a community problem. Your neighborhood beekeeper's mite problem is your mite problem, whether you realize it or not. There's been a lot of conjecture on the next statement. Keeping bees without controlling varroa should be considered irresponsible, even unethical, due to the effects on others within a 3-mile radius. I know a lot of treatment-free persons have and take issue with that, but I'm not going to go there. I'm just covering what was captured here. It goes on to indicate that successful beekeepers with less than 10% colony losses last year typically treated 4 times using different products. And that's the thing you're hearing a lot out of BIP, is their preference would be several small treatments or several effective treatments if your mite loads indicate to treat through the year instead of one big one once a year. So I didn't go in depth of everything that was captured. I'm skipping through some of the notes here and picking out the summary points. I'll remind you again. It says, if you use a varroa treatment product, the goal is to achieve at least 80% knockdown rate. Bees must be tested, meaning sampled, before and after the treatment to determine mite status, get data, and determine if your treatment worked. And it shares here that there is a tool for varroa management available, because a lot of people ask, well, if I'm going to do this all year, which treatment should I do and when? You can go to honeybeehealthcoalition.org/varroa. We'll have a link to that in the show notes to get to the tools for varroa management resource guide. Two more things I wanted to call out of this that I read. The first one, I'm just going to read the full paragraph out. Fungicides may have a sublethal effect on the colony or its bees, and this is not yet fully understood. New studies have discovered entombed pollen, bee bread, that is often covered in a red propolis-like capping in the cell. Hives with entombed pollen are 3 times more likely to die. The possible answer is fungicide in the pollen within these cells kills the yeast, preventing fermentation, so when the pollen rots, meaning it disintegrates, it releases pesticides into the surrounding wax. The colonies that have this present are 3 times more likely to experience a queen event and resulting loss of the colony. That's an interesting thing. And again, the first time I ever heard about the secret toxic potion of this was from Marianne Fraser talking about the work in Penn State about fungicides, which on their own are generally not considered to be harmful to bees, mixed with other chemicals coming in, create a more potent mix. And that's an interesting paragraph to chew on. So the last bit of knowledge I'll share out of here is DVE recommends replacing about 2 out of every 10 frames each year, but not more than that. At our most recent meeting, someone just asked about that, and we were talking about the strategy to do this. He suggests of thinking that the comb is a living entity, and if possible, the comb needs to be cared for and kept alive by the bees. From the notes, it looks like he's saying a bee should not be considered an organism. The bees in the colony, along with the comb, are the organism. In fact, it's a superorganism. So remember Dennis Van Engelsdorp talking about the fact that he liked having older comb, even though he understood some of the dangers of that, because the comb wicks everything in. He liked having it because he did feel it was part of the ecosystem. But that's interesting. The recommendation is 2 combs a year out of 10. So I only give you a taste of this. Again, like the previous segment, I'm going to recommend you go to the Susquehanna Beekeepers Association and look up the notes for their March 9th meeting. While you're there, take a look around. There's a lot of information. I see Joe posts some topics up there and other beekeepers. It looks like they're a very proactive group, and you'll find a lot of neat resources there. One thing Joe had was a queen calendar available to people. And I think it's worth taking a look, and you'll find the full notes of what I read the summaries out of up there. And it's certainly worth a look, because there's several topics that I left out, but I don't have enough time to cover it in full detail here on the podcast. So the address for the Susquehanna Beekeepers Association, which is located in Hartford and Cecil counties in Maryland, is SusquehannaBeekeepers.com. And the other place, as always, that you can be referred to is BeInformed.org. It's B-E-E for honeybees. BeInformed.org. That's the Be Informed Partnership website. Once again, I have to say thanks to Joe Lewis. He's been sending some stuff along, and I really find it useful to share this out. And these notes were outstanding. So hats off to Susquehanna for sharing the wealth and helping to educate other beekeepers. That wraps up the segment section of the podcast. Let's flip to the back of the book. We'll talk about roundtable number 1, American Honey Tasting Society. I wanted to share 2 resources, the Honey Aroma / Flavor Wheel and the Fund Color Chart. Fund spelling P-F-U-N-D. If you go to AmericanHoneyTastingSociety.com website, you can click on the link for honey tasting assets, and you'll find those 2 resources that I had there. The aroma and tasting wheel is an interesting thing. It has 3 dynamics of it. The inside one gives you kind of what the temperature slash how do you describe this? Tasting aroma feeling is. Is it floral? Is it fruity? Is it warm? Is it fresh tasting? Does it taste chemical? Does it have a woody taste? That type of thing. And then around the outside of the center, you'll find another dynamic where you have something where you would give a label to the type of honey that you have. How would you describe the honey? Is it earthy? Does it have a flowery taste? Is it fresh tasting? Does it have a little bit of a berry note or citrus note? Could it be burned or caramel tasting? Is it green tasting, real grassy-like or dry? Does it have a spicy kind of taste or medicinal quality? You get the gist of it. Then around the furthest outside of the wheel, it's similar to the wine descriptions that you get where people talk about the notes that come through. Maybe you get this prune, raisin, fig, apricot, cooked fruit, jammy, candied fruit kind of taste in your honey. Maybe it's butterscotch, toffee, brown sugar, beeswax, a little bit of flavor. Maybe it's a lemony flavor or rosemary flavor. Maybe you're getting a wood or a cedar taste or some sort of incense or oaky kind of taste. You get the gist here where people talk about the terroir, the land that it comes from. These are the flavors that you pick up on the notes. And what's interesting about aroma and tasting is it does have a very similar profile, as far as I'm concerned, to some of the things that get rated the most common thing being wine. You get the back taste, the front taste, the side taste, the lingering taste, the sharp taste, the taste in the tongue, tip of your tongue, and all of those things. How do you describe all those? Well, when they go out and taste honeys across the world, they can use this aroma and tasting wheel to go ahead and judge where the honey falls into place. So that's a pretty cool resource. And maybe like us in our Beekeepers Association, you could have a honey tasting and have people go and practice using the wheel. So the other resource about this, and this is more of a gauge that you can describe your honey if you're selling it or collecting it or have an interest to this, is there are 7 designated colors of honey varying in intensity from a whitish style, almost water white, to a dark amber. So number 1 is water white, that's what it's called. Number 2 is extra white. Number 3 is white. Number 4 is extra light amber. The next one is light amber, amber, and dark amber. And they give you this chart with a color tone, and you could hold your honey to the chart and see where it falls, and you could classify your honey on the color guide. So the standard system for measuring the color of liquid honey is called the FUND, P-F-U-N-D, color grading system. And it uses the relative lightness or darkness of amber on a scale in millimeters. So while you're visiting the website, check out some of the things they have. They have their mission listed, but they also have a honey tasting course. Well, they'll bring honey in if you wanted to host one of these, I'll call it a party or event, and they'll do an introduction session to honey tasting. So click around. They have pictures of events that they've run and things like that, and it looks like a pretty neat thing to consider participating in. If at minimum, you could just use the charts and do your own little event, but it would be neat to bring them in. How about that? So this is something that's been around for a while, and if you're really into it and want to become a member, it's $35 a year, and it gives you a subscription to their newsletter. You could sit in on honey tasting socials. There's 10% discount on all educational honey tasting courses and a number of other perks. This isn't a commercial for them, just something you'll see if you go take a look. Looks like a neat place to spend a little time browsing. It's AmericanHoneyTastingSociety.com. Roundtable number 2, Megan Denver and Tom Seeley. I wanted to point out a video that got posted not too long ago to Finding Wild Honeybees. It was published March 4th, 2016, and it shows a bee hunting trip with Dr. Thomas Seeley and Megan Denver. My guess is this was shot by Jorik Phillips, who Jorik and Megan are part of the Hudson Valley Bee Supply. We met them at a Northeast meeting, and Bob Kloss, as I mentioned recently, stopped by there to pick up some supplies on his way back from New York State. So if you watch this video available on YouTube, you're going to see something that I got to experience firsthand when I went to the Eastern Apiculture Society meeting a couple years ago, and that's Dr. Tom Seeley explaining how he does finding feral bees and or honeybees from the wild. And it's funny to watch him because his routine is almost exactly the way that he described it. Now, in EAS, I brought my camera and I filmed him, but out of respect for him and the class that he showed there, I really didn't want to post that, but I've been able to watch it personally over and over again, was always enthralled by his method. Well, now you can watch the exact same video, but he actually does it in a field, and he explained his process by which he goes out in the field, he uses his box to capture the bees, he feeds the bees, he marks the bees, and he explains how he tracks them back to their hive. It is really, really, really worth taking a look at this. So I'll post a video link to this YouTube, or you can look at Megan Denver's channel. The video is called Finding Wild Honeybees. I'm assuming you could search and find that straight away from YouTube search, but we'll have a link to the video, and I really recommend you go check it out. I've given you guys a lot of homework assignments this week. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that Megan Denver and Tom Seeley have teamed up recently to release a new book, Following the Wild Honeybees. It's out by Princeton University Press, and you can order that book at press.princeton.edu. I'll even give you the full URL, and again, you can find this in the notes. titles/10669.html. That's press.princeton.edu/titles/10669.html. You can also check out more of Tom's upcoming talks at beehunting.com. And of course, we'll have all three of those links.
Well, once they fill this up, I would take it away and put another super, because they can't get beyond this one.
Right.
So you can't put another super on top of it.
Right.
Right? I guess you could under super it. You could put a super below it, but then they're going to fill all of that before they come up and you fill this. So I would put it on, let them fill it up, take it off, and then put your regular supers on, see if you can get some more honey out of that hive.
Roundtable number three, that voice you just heard was Bob Kloss doing a snippet at our recent Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers meeting. He was talking about his Jaropack Honey Super. It's a mason jar fitted on a flat board that you would put over top of a honey super, and the bees will build comb and store honey in that comb in the mason jars that sit over top of a box during a heavy hive flow. That was just one of the things mentioned. And if you're interested in that, as you heard him say, the Fat Bee Man, I think that was in that snippet. The Fat Bee Man was the guy who inspired Bob to build his device. And we'll have that on display at the Gadget Garage at our spring meeting and at the Eastern Apiculture Society meeting going on in July. In addition to what Bob showed, Jim Schmalz showed a oxalic acid vaporizer that he built. I've talked about that, and we talked a little bit about how that was used. And we also spent a lot of time talking about spring management and different findings and so on. The third thing that was available there was a B-yard bench that I recently constructed. In fact, I made two of them, put one together and have one to go. The B-yard bench, I featured a video on making that recently on my YouTube channel. It came from a January 2012 edition of Bee Culture that tells you how long ago I was waiting to make this. It's on page 57 of that edition. And while you can get the measurements and see the pictures and whatever from that edition, if you happen to have it on hand, my recommendation is you go to the Bee Vlog on YouTube. B-E-E-V-L-O-G, Bee Vlog. Bill Catherell is the keeper of that. He has a lot of interesting articles and information up there. In fact, he was interviewed by the Kiwiumana Buzz after I procrastinated and didn't get to it. So sorry about that, Bill. But Bill has his shot of the bench that he made. And he also has, in his demonstration of that, measurements that he tweaked from the original one that make more sense, and that's the pattern that I used. So if you go to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/NWNJBA, and look for the Bee Yard Hive Bench, look in the comments there, and you'll see a link to Bill's video at the Bee Vlog. And on his video, in his comments, he has links to a Facebook page and others that have the better diagram to follow. I think it's better if you go to his site and get the information. So anyway, this is a really cool bench. The top of it looks like a mini ladder. It has fold-out legs that go out. And it's the perfect size to set a hive box on instead of setting it down in the grass. And I know there's some commentary about the common practice when you work on a hive is you take the roof off, the outer cover, and you flip it over and you set it upside down in the grass. And subsequently, any other boxes that you have, you take off. You don't set them down in the dirt or in the grass. You set them on your box. On your lid. But you know, sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you want to put a box down and then take the box that you set on the lid and put that back on the stack. Here with the hive bench, you could put boxes on the bench and not have to put them down on the ground. As an added bonus, it folds up, so it makes it pretty portable, and it's easy to move from hive to hive or put in your vehicle. The third thing about this bench is the dimensions of it are perfect so that it will hold a frame. So if you take a frame out, instead of putting the frame down, and you know, sometimes you use frame hangers, but sometimes you need a place for it. It'll set perfectly in the bench because the rails are spaced so that the hangers of the ears of the frame will set on that. So I think I've described it enough. Go check it out. I'll have a link to the video that I have, and I'll also put a link to Bill's Bee Vlog, and you could check that out. And while I'm at it, why not? I'll throw a link over to episode number 75 so you can hear him get interviewed by Gary at Kiwiumana Buzz. So check it out. That's pretty cool. And, you know, we had a good meeting. It was a small crew. I was a little bit disappointed by that. We did do our honey tasting recipes. They came out great. Thanks to everybody who brought something. And our next meeting at Northwest is going to be on April 16th. It's a live bee meeting. And then the meeting after that is the state meeting on April 23rd. So lots of things going on, and I'm sure we'll get to talk about that before we close out the episode or in our next one. We'll see how I feel and where I'm running on time. One other thing that was a surprise to show and tell there was that John Neal, one of our new members, brought his flow hive in. And you know, darn it, I got to see it, but I really didn't get to do hands-on. I was so busy at the meeting, and unfortunately, he had to leave before the meeting was over. I really wanted to take the camera and have him hold the thing up and take some shots. And if you go and watch the Bee Yard Hive Bench video, you'll see his flow hive box was sitting on the bench in the picture on the opening. So he did hold it up. He did show the metal key, I'll call it, that you put in and turn. And I got to see how the hive worked, but I really wanted to get him on film. And I would assume he still has it. Maybe I could talk him into bringing it back to the next meeting, but I got to get my hands on a real flow hive and see what it looks like, and that's pretty cool. So I really appreciate him bringing that along. Roundtable number four, I want to talk about an article that I found on a website, klamathbeekeepers.org. I'm assuming they're somewhere in Oregon based on what their homepage shows. It's about making a veil on a budget. And I just liked the picture and thought it was pretty cool on what they had done. So in the article, they had a step-by-step instruction on how to build your own veil. And it used a hat that you could buy. You ever see the hats that you wear, like in the summertime, the big floppy ones? It turns out they have the same shape as a helmet that you would buy for a veil. And it looks like they work perfectly. And you could buy some fabric from the fabric store. The kind that gives you the best vision, right? You want to buy the right kind of fabric. And just simply sew them together and make yourself a homemade veil. And, I don't know if the helmets and the veils sometimes from the beekeeper catalogs, they're more pricey than I would have thought. And here you can make your own. So I'll have a link to that. I don't know if I'm a seamstress enough to go ahead and make a run on this. I'll have to talk to Sharon and see if they would do it. And I have two veils at my disposal anyway, but one of my veils, the veil part, is actually not very good shape. So it could use a replacement. And I never really liked looking through it. It has like this yellow mesh and it gets in the way. And, maybe this summer I'll find a way to do it, and I'll have a link to this and go ahead and try it off. But, click the link, check out the picture of the veil that they have, and then if you're interested and you're handy, you could do it yourself. Pretty cool. Roundtable number five, I found something called the perfect hive stand. This was on beehacker.com, and I'm going to read it verbatim. I'll give you a link to it. But I thought it was pretty interesting. This is the time of year where a lot of people put new hives out. And the whole key here is to explain to you, don't put your hives on the ground. It's really important to get them up off the ground. Even if you choose to put them on cinder blocks, put them on something. So on this website, it talks about the perfect hive stand should do the following. One, provide sturdy support for a hive off the moist ground. Recall that bees evolved to live in trees, not in the ground like yellow jackets. Being close to the ground results in cooler temperatures and higher humidity. Cooler temperatures mean the bees delay and shorten their forage time, and high humidity makes their job of evaporating water out of nectar to make honey that much harder. Yet the hive should be not so high that the beekeeper has to get on a ladder to reach the supers. Look for a hive stand that may be a wee bit tall. Consider the beehive at the White House. That thing was ridiculous if you saw that thing. It was like a pillar. He thought that 18 inches was a fair compromise in his first commentary. The other reason a hive stand would be put into place is to discourage animals such as skunks or raccoons who might be attracted to the rich protein. It allows enabled screen bottom boards to do their job, drop mites, hive beetles, and other stuff out of the bottom. Putting them up on a hive stand allows you to discourage ants. You could put something on the legs or stand them in a bowl of water. It keeps your bees relaxed. It's easy and it should be cheap to build these things, and hopefully you choose a method that lasts a long time. So this is not a shameless plug, just a commentary because it came through. Wade Pinkston sent me a message with two pictures of hive stands that he made from the BK Corner hive stand design, which is on our homepage. The first one went together perfectly. The second one he had to cut a little bit differently. My guess and what his commentary was is there's 2-inch little shims that help join some of the flat parts together, and it sounds like, based on his commentary, he cut them a little bit short. The reason I wanted to mention what Wade put together was that he said he watched the video of the construction of the stands and mentioned that I said using a PVC cutter sometimes resulted in a crooked cut. He sent the guidance that if you take the PVC cutter and you squeeze it down on the PVC and you run it in a circle, it'll score the surface around the outside. And then as you squeeze the PVC cutter, it'll follow the scored area and it will cut straight every time. So Wade, that is brilliant. Thank you, thank you, thank you for that tip. I always never liked the way it cut crooked. And that does make a problem sometimes when you put the shims together. If you get a crooked cut, sometimes it ends up being longer than 2 inches and your hive stand doesn't fit together as perfectly as you want. So kudos for that tip. If you're interested in the hive stand design, you can look there. You could also go to B-Source and other bee forums and look. There's a bunch of different hive stand things out there. In fact, I just bought the parts and pieces 4x4 to put my Waré hive on a hive stand. I decided to build a wood one and not one of my PVC ones, although I have the parts to build another PVC one this year, and I'm going to put that together. And one thing I never did was make a video of the actual construction of that. So this spring, when and if I ever get any time, I'm going to put that together and film it out. I'm happy to say I just paid to have my camera fixed, and they're shipping it back to me. It took a month to get the parts for it. Apparently, they were on back order, and my camera should be arriving back to me, hopefully safe and sound, any day in the mail. So pretty excited to get that back, and we'll shoot a number of features here when we get it back in action. So the perfect hive stand, I'll provide a link to that. It's beehacker.com/WP/page ID number 22. You don't have to remember that. Just go to our show notes. Roundtable number 6, throw one more on the pile. This one comes out of the Washington Post. It was sent by listener Jim Farrell. Thanks, Jim, for sending this over. The title of the article is Maryland's Honeybees Are Being Massacred and the Weapon Might Be in Your House. This is an article written by Daryl Fears. It was released on March 24th. And it goes into the commentary from the Maryland lawmakers who banned pesticides in Maryland and neonicotinoids. It goes in to say that they have denied the ability for people in the state from buying products that contain neonicotinoids. And they list a number of them: Knockout Ready to Use Grub Killer, Ortho Bug Be Gone, All in One Rose and Flower Care, Lesco Bandit Insecticide, and other products at 3,000 hardware stores, garden centers, nurseries, and other outlets in the states. It goes on to comment that, of course, usage would be banned from buying them in the stores, but people could probably buy the stuff over the internet and have it shipped in. It was something sponsored by Senator Shirley Nathan Pulliam of Baltimore County. That's the person who authored the companion bill. And how about that? Something going on there in Maryland. And maybe this will start the tide of different legislatures around the United States getting with the program. As a counterpoint somewhere in the article, it says agriculture, quote, has not documented any cases of neonicotinoid pesticides negatively impacting honeybees in Maryland. That's coming from Maryland's Department of Agriculture, who disagreed with this. And there was little scientific evidence linking it to neonicotinoids, but perhaps Maryland went the Europe route and just thought, because it hasn't been proven yet that this is or is not, they decided to ban it. There's a quip in the article that talks about Steve McDaniel, owner of McDaniel Honey Farms, saying he lost 50% of his hives where he lives in Manchester, Maryland, and 100% down in the Baltimore area since 2012, somewhere around 20 hives each year. It goes on to say, I've had them there for 30 years, and he's a master beekeeper. In the last 4 years, I can't keep them alive no matter what I do. The trouble is they started selling these pesticides to homeowners. They put these things on flowers that bloom within a mile of the beehive, and no one can offer me a reasonable explanation of any other cause for what I've been seeing. So it's an interesting piece, and I won't go any further into it. Again, I'll provide a link to it. It's under the Energy and Environment section of the Washington Post. And again, one more time, thanks, Jim, for sending this along. Appreciate you tipping us off to it. That's all I intended to cover for this episode. I see that we're about an hour and 15 minutes in. Wanted to offer a couple closing comments. Lauren Bruns, I have those videos that you sent along. I'm going to take a look at those. The one that is the two-frame video is in the queue. I watched some of it, and I'm pretty intrigued. And I'm going to see if I can do a review of that and bring it back for the next episode. So keep sending that stuff, and I am taking a look at it. I wanted to mention to the listeners that I have gone to the dark side. While I still absolutely love my Windows phone, it's time for a renewal. And for the first time ever, Apple has received some of my money. I know I've bashed Apple. I still dislike their practices being a mobile person. But at some point, you have to understand that Apple rules the world and all the services for mobile come on Apple. And I, like the sheep, have gone to the dark side. My iPad from work sits in my bag, but I have spent some of my own money, and my team teases me all the time, and purchased an iPhone 6S Plus, which arrives on Tuesday. Well, this had nothing to do with that. That was a knee-jerk reaction recently. I had an email surface through my podcast that said you can get an iPhone app relatively quickly if you had a WordPress blog by just feeding the URL to the blog into an app maker and it spits an app out. And I did that. And yes, if you go look in the Apple Store, you'll find a BK Corner app in there with our blog information. The problem is it doesn't work right. The API, the application programming interface, for whatever reason, stripped off the podcast part where you can't see the MP3s. So being a podcaster, what good is the blog post if it rips out the MP3 link? But it does have me intrigued. I'm going to have to go look. But for now, that app is out there. If you search in the App Store for Beekeeper's Corner Podcast, you'll find it. And you could click on it. It'll take you back to our website where you can click on the MP3 and watch it that way. But I suspect most of you look at my stuff from a podcast app and not my website, but you could go to bkcorner.org, click on each of the episodes, and listen to the MP3 from there. Anyway, just wanted to mention that there is now an official app. I don't know how long it's going to stay out there before I replace it with something better. But I wanted to let you know that I have entered into the fray. So the warm weather has come and gone and come and gone. And I'm really looking forward to probably next weekend starting to get into my hives. And really enjoying the beekeeping season coming in. Hopefully I'll have enough time to do my splits and get all the stuff I want to do going here. Excited about getting my new hives going. My Waray and my Topar once again. And man, the beekeeper season is here. It's here. I can taste it. And I'm really looking forward to it. So on that happy note, I will share with you that, like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening. And until next time, be well.